My name is Gary Bornson, and I teach at Fairhaven College of Western Washington University. Would you like to come around here farther? Would you mind doing that? Because I'm going to try to talk this direction. And I have a cold, and that's the usual apology, so that any mistakes I make are not my fault. I wanted to talk this morning about computers. As of last year, for the first time, I taught a course at Western Washington University. It was called The Computer Revolution. And we dealt with not computer programming so much, or computer skills, or what computers can do and how fantastic they are, although there were elements of that in it. We did teach a little bit about programming in basic language, which is one of the common languages. We taught a little bit about word processing. We talked a little bit about how computers work. But then about half the course was devoted to looking at the effects of the computer revolution on people and on society. This set it apart from any other courses that were being taught at the university. And I suppose made me rather unpopular in the political science or in the computer science department. I'm not sure. For text, for that course, I used a book called Computer Power and Human Reason by Joseph Weizenbaum. And it's a pretty high level, pretty sophisticated book that I don't recommend to you, especially unless you really want to get into the philosophical aspects of how computers change the way we think and the way we regard ourselves, and what kinds of tasks computers ought not be asked to do. Weizenbaum in particular is rather critical of military applications of computers, as you can see when you get into the last chapter of the book. It's sort of an anti-rationalist treatise, and I have to admit that some of my values have been tweaked by a book like this. A book that's a little more, Weizenbaum himself is a computer science instructor at MIT, so he speaks with some authority. A more recent book, this was about 8 years old or so, a more recent book, which I didn't have at my disposal when I taught my course, which just came out this year, is called The Second Self by Sherry Turkle. Second self being the computer. It's an extension of certain aspects of ourselves into a machine. And I'd like to just read a little bit off the jacket of Sherry's book. It's 1795. That's on the jacket. I imagine within a year it'll probably be out in paperback and be able to get it under $10. In this important and original book, The Study of Culture in the Making, the author writes, "Most considerations of the computer concentrate on the instrumental computer, on what work the computer will do. But I am interested in the subjective computer, that is, the machine as it enters social life and psychological development, the computer as it affects the way that we think, especially the way that we think about ourselves. I believe what fascinates me is the unstated question that lies behind much of our preoccupation with the computer's capabilities. The question is not what will the computer be like in the future, but what will we be like? What kind of people are we becoming?" This is the question she explores in the book, and it's fascinating reading. In the end, she's probably fairly sympathetic to computers. I think she feels like if we work around with our minds carefully enough, the net result of computerization can be a positive one. I'm much more ambivalent. I have both positive feelings and negative feelings, and my negative feelings, especially in preparation for a talk like this, tend to outweigh my positive ones. I've worked with computers for a lot of years. I was in high school, a freshman in high school back in 1958, and had the privilege of going to a math camp as a young freshman out of town, down in Tallahassee, Florida, and I lived up in Chicago, and sponsored by the National Science Foundation. And one of the things they did at this math camp was to teach us how to use computers, and that was back in the days when they were made out of vacuum tubes, and you used punch cards to program them, and the machine would sit there and crank through these cards. And we could only write programs in machine language then. I don't think Fortran had even been invented at that point, or it was shortly after that, or around that time, Fortran was one of the first languages that facilitated the programming of the machines. But we didn't learn anything about that. We learned in the machine language, which means you just write a whole string of numbers, and you have to get the code that those numbers represent. That was a fascinating experience for me. I loved it. I just really got caught up in it. I thought they were really neat. I'd stay awake late at night working on computer programs. I became a computer nerd. And I suppose it's typical that when people get enamored with something, if they ever later become disillusioned with it, they're going to be all the more passionate in their disillusionment. So that that may account for some of my evangelical fervor against computers now. I've gone on since then and went through the whole science program in high school and college. That was the 59 was Sputnik, I think it was 58, somewhere around the end of the 50s, and there was a great big push to try to get. I think it was 56. Anybody know what Sputnik was? 56, 57, yeah. It was a little earlier than that. Just before I went into high school. And so there was the big push then to get anybody who could think at all, shove them into the sciences, shove them into math, and there were all kinds of government money available. It's somewhat paralleled by the reaction nowadays when Reagan's trying to get the country back on its feet again, and the way of seeing that, the way of pushing ourselves into the new age by as seen by technocrats as being to get our young people educated in science and mathematics. You know, the heck with the humanities, the heck with social sciences or economics or anything that deals with social problems. We just have to get our technology going and back on its feet again. And that was very much the feeling that was around in the late 60s, which is, late 50s and early 60s that some of you remember. Anyway, I went through the math science regimen. I did well. I went to Caltech as an undergraduate and University of Colorado as a grad student. Finished off a PhD in 1972. But all that time, little by little, although I was having a number of computer courses along the way and all, I did some computer work over the summers. I worked for Electronics Motorola Corporation, electronics firm. I started getting these little feelings of there must be something wrong with these things. And those feelings have grown. I was excited to see the advent of microcomputers. I thought, aha, now we're getting the computers in the hands of the people. Before that, it was all centralization. You know, computers were things that only big corporations could use, and people couldn't use them. But now, with microcomputers, you feel like there's a tendency toward democratization of the process. And I'm kind of excited about that. But I'm afraid, and my general feeling is that we still are, that the centralization process is definitely at a faster pace and a higher rate than the decentralization process. And even though we common folk may have gained a little bit of ground by being able to have these critters in our homes, I think maybe we're losing more than we're gaining in the whole process. So I want to share some of my ambivalence with you. I've got about six reasons. I think they're somewhat different from each other, dealing with why I'm uncomfortable with the rate of computerization and with the whole process of computerization as it's occurring in our society, given the dominant social values that control the way that computerization takes place. Before I start listing my things, I want to just give you a couple scandalous facts, like microcomputer advertising in 1984 was $700 million, almost $1 billion of advertising. That's just the microcomputer industry, and that's multiplied, at least the glorious effects of what microcomputers can do for us, is amplified by or multiplied by the advertising of other industries that extol the virtues of microcomputers, microchips, and electronic technology. The automobiles and the military, all the ads seem to point toward a high-tech future because there's a lot of money in that future for certain people. The people that have the money now in this country will get more money if we go the direction of a high-tech future. The interesting thing is that recognizing that, and recognizing that there's a grassroots dis-ease or discomfort with computers and high-tech, the ads tend to downplay that aspect of it. On the one hand, they'll say these are grand, glorious things, but on the other hand, they'll say they're liberating, they'll set you free. Well, you've probably heard that computers set you free, they aid democracy, they bring you the power to live your own life on your own terms. They show the pictures of children, little nice family scenes, and it brings the families together, right? there's also the ads are convincing us that we can't live without them, that either you can't live without them, or your business can't do without it, or your children can't survive in the future if they don't have computer literacy and computer training. And that message is really coming through strong. Universities are just pushing computer literacy, computer training, and there's all kinds of government money behind it, as though it's the only way into the future. And my fear is that maybe that's true. Maybe it's true that we are going to create a society where if you do not know how to use computers, you're going to be at such a disadvantage that you're really going to be up the creek. That, to me, would be a grave mistake.
Gary, that's true in schools, too. Schools are pushing that.
The grade schools?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Computer literacy is mm-hmm. one of the objectives of most school districts now.
And yet, survey was made in 1984 and found that of the 12,000 wealthiest schools in the country, they are four times more likely to have computers, microcomputers, than the 12,000 poorest schools in the country. That's not surprising. Of course, the wealthy school is going to be able to afford the things, going to buy them first, and so all the children in the wealthy school systems are going to have this so-called privilege, and which may be a privilege. It will indeed probably increase their earning power in the future, whereas the children in the 12,000 poorest schools will not have access even to computer education. Twice as many 13-year-olds in the urban schools use them regularly as in rural or ghetto schools. It's about 32% as compared to 17%. And then there's the difference between boys and girls. In the basically, the computer area is a boy's area, and it's a man's area. In the school system, the boys preferentially will take computer programming courses. The girls might take something like word processing because they have this image of the woman secretary, and that's what they think they're going to become or that they're programmed to become. Even the ads in computers, 69% of the ads, this was another study made about a year ago, 69% of the ads showed only boys or men dealing with the computers. A number of them showed mixed, but 13% of them showed only women. In the cases where they're mixed, either the man is in an obvious sort of dominant position in the ads, I mean, I was noticing this myself, where the man is the one who really kind of knows how to do things, or else it just seems blatantly obvious that the woman is put in some kind of a superior position that looks silly, that just looks like it's very intentional reverse discrimination. And that's hard to document. I mean, that's just my prejudice, and it's hard to verify that quantitatively. But it's just just keep your eyes open on computer ads and look at the role, the gender roles in computer ads.
There's one for Apple or something where there's a little girl, she's puzzling with a computer, and the boy looks at her. He has a fork. I can't believe they get away with that.
Another survey was made of use of computer-centered facilities outside of class, and I think this was high school age. And they would try to encourage both boys and girls to be in the classes, but then they look outside of class and see who was using the facilities outside of class, and it was all the boys. Basically, the computer center becomes boys' turf, and the girls just don't invade that territory. They checked summer camps, like the one that I went to when I was a freshman in high school. At that particular summer camp, I remember there were three girls, and there were about 30 boys. It's a math camp sponsored by the National Science Foundation. In other words, girls aren't interested in mathematics, or girls don't do mathematics. They do other things. Now it's not quite that bad, I don't suppose, but they did find at computer math camps a 3-to-1 ratio between boys and girls. And as the courses at these camps increased in difficulty, the proportion of girls in the courses declined accordingly. So that the girls would go in at the entry level and they would study at a 3-to-1 ratio maybe. The computers at the level of word processing or simple programming. But as the program became more advanced or more technical or more high level, more sophisticated languages and so forth, then the girls' proportion dropped down to like 7% or 5%. I'm not sure what that says, and I guess I don't want to try and speculate too much, but I'm just saying that something's going on there when you have these gross inequities. One article I have here that I'm not going to take time to read comes up with 29 speculations on why these discrepancies exist. And some of them are good ones, I think. Some of them are very likely to be the reasons, but they're proposing that studies be made as to determine why the girls are being, in effect, pretty systematically excluded from the computer world. And what that says about the nature of computers themselves, which is a question Sherry Turkle gets into. She's the anomalous female computer programmer on the MIT faculty. Okay. Most of what I want to say today, and I'm going to try to leave a good block of time at the end for input from you folks, is my own reflections, which you've heard a lot of already, and you get the sense of my biases. But an article that I would recommend deals with these questions and that I'm going to basically go through and paraphrase and summarize for you as quickly as I can, called Six Grave Doubts About Computers. It's by Jerry Mander, weird name, a fellow that wrote a book back a few years ago that some of you may have read called Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television. It's a book that's been used on college campuses in some sociology courses critiquing the television phenomenon.
What's the
title of the article is Six Grave Doubts About Computers. And it appeared in the, I could make copies for you here at a dime a page. I guess they'll do Xeroxing at the village. But it appeared in the last fall's issue of Whole Earth News and Whole Earth Software Catalog. What is it? Coevolution Quarterly and Whole Earth Software Catalog have just combined into one publication. And it's called Whole Earth Review. And they had an article, they had a whole issue devoted to kind of critique of computers. And of that issue, I think this was the best single article. Starts out the article looking at the promise of the technological future, recounting his own experiences. He's about 5 years older than me. No, let's see, 5, 41, 9 years older than me. Makes him about 50. And he shared a very similar experience to mine of being told as a child that the future was going to be grand because we would have all this fantastic computerization, we'd have robots, we'd have we'd all be flying around with little rocket packs on our backs, and we'd be commuting to work in airplanes, not cars. We'd have solved the smog problem. There wasn't even a smog problem in the 50s and 40s, except in LA already. Basically, there was a lot of promise in that era. Oh, nuclear energy, that was going to solve all the energy problem. Energy would be cheap, readily available. We could do anything we wanted to because we'd have so much of it. And the forecast for prosperity by the 1980s were just outrageous. Remember that mood, that euphoria, that post-war euphoria that really promised an incredible future and somehow failed to anticipate the social stresses that we're undergoing, or to recognize that, sure, for a very small fraction of the population, the U.S. is 6% of the world's population, about probably down to 5% by now. For a very small percentage of the population, and a small percentage of that percentage, all the goodies are there. We do have people able to fly around in planes. We do have robots. We do have microwave ovens. You push the buttons and everything cooks out real easily. There's a lot of conveniences for a very small fraction of the population. But a lot of those promises haven't materialized. And one of the things that he wants to try to analyze in this article is, why don't those promises come about? Why doesn't the high-tech society pay off benefits to everybody? I'll read just a few paragraphs here. The first several waves of news concerning a new technological innovation are invariably positive, or even utopian. This is so because the information comes mostly from the people who stand to gain from society taking a favorable view and thereby promoting that technology. This has definitely been the case then in the case of microcomputers, which he argues. And finally he says, all this advertising, added to the praise heaped upon computers by scientists, industrial leaders, even politicians, combines to create an overwhelming climate of optimistic expectation, which is now ubiquitous. Most people, not technically trained, living in a society which views technology skeptically, and not practiced... No, I'm sorry. Most people not technically trained and not living in a society which views technology skeptically and not practiced in criticism, tend to accept the corporate agenda or to view the machines from the isolated perspective of their own interactions with them. If you look at your own interactions with the machines, for some people, this has been extremely negative. They've basically turned off to these machines. They feel like I don't like the way they rule my life. But it's maybe 50-50. There's about another half of the people that say, hey, they're kind of fun. Hey, I can relate to these things, and they do help make my job a little easier. But he's saying, let's not just look at how they affect us individually, personally, but let's look more holistically at the whole picture and see what they're doing to the society. We need to view the computer for the totality of its effects upon society and life on Earth, and ask questions which will bring forth that picture. How do computers affect concentrations of wealth and power? Who gains and who loses because of their existence? Do computers have environmental effects? What are they? What about diversity of culture and thought? The way we work and who gets to work and who doesn't get to work? What are the effects on what we know and what we are capable of knowing? What is gained and what is lost? These are all questions which should be asked. So first, let's look at how clean computers are. Computers are heralded as a clean industry. Silicon Valley was set up, and everybody wants to bring computers into their regions, computer production into their regions. I live in Bellingham. It's a big, it's kind of a depressed area, Bellingham, Washington. And they want to bring industry in. And what industries are the best ones? Everybody knows the high-tech industries like computers are really fine because they're such clean industries. But is this really true, or is this just an image that the industry has been promoting? What are the effects of computers on the environment, and what are the effects of computers on people? Is there a free lunch? This author says, the effects upon users include such relatively minor problems as fatigue, eye strain, migraines, and backaches, as well as more serious problems like cataracts, and among women who work with video display terminals, reports of miscarriages and birth defects. And this has been actually, they find a statistical increase in miscarriages and birth defects from people working with, for people working with video display terminals. It's suspected that it may not be a physical thing, it may not be the radiation or anything, it may just be the unique special kind of stress that's associated with working with these video display terminals. Meanwhile, very little has been reported about the effects on people at the production end of the cycle. Lately, workers in Silicon Valley have been protesting that they, too, are experiencing high rates of miscarriage and other reproductive system problems, as well as loss of hair, chronic asthma, other disorders of apparently resulting from the handling of toxic chemicals and gases involved in computer chip manufacture. Workers in the general this is attorney Ted Smith of the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition. Workers in the general population are being exposed to the most deadly chemicals that have ever been synthesized. Dr. Joseph LaDon of the Division of Occupational and Environmental Medicine at University of California says the computer industry has a high incidence of occupational illness, more than three times the average manufacturing industry. That appalled me. I couldn't imagine
that. What chemicals are being used to say that?
Computer manufacturing produces more than 2 million gallons, uses more than 2 million gallons of acids, 500,000 gallons of solvents. These have found their way into leaky toxic dump sites. High concentrations of trichloroethylene, which is a solvent, recently showed up in the drinking water of several communities in Silicon Valley. The EPA has identified 80 such chemical spill sites around the country, some of which will be added to the government's Superfund cleaning up program. Now, that's not terribly indicting. I mean, there's other industries that are highly polluting, too. But I guess the one that kind of got me was the three times incidence of occupational illness than average of manufacturing industries. That statistic, by the way, comes not from the lawyer representing the people that are complaining, but came from the Chief of Division of Occupational and Environmental Medicine at University of California, which I think is probably a little less biased of a reporter, but you got to take some of this with a grain of salt. Just all I'm saying is it's not pollution-free. Okay, it's not as clean as the ads and the hype would have you believe. Secondly, hold on, let me write these down. On feelings, actually on the devaluation of feelings. Computers don't process feelings. They process data, right? Process numbers. They process letters, information. Information to a computer means a set of on-off pulses. It's all digitized. Communication is coming to mean a string of digitized pulses sent via satellite somewhere. If that's how we define information and communication, whatever happened to hugs? Whatever happened to body language? Whatever happened to human interaction? It starts being excluded, devalued. Feelings and emotions, things that can't be quantified, taste. Those qualities of life, which are very human and I value highly, tend to be devalued in a society that calls information a string of zeros and ones on off binary digit bits, or calls communication those things that can be sent via satellite. Computers do not judge. They don't make judgments. They calculate. They do make decisions. You can program computers to make decisions, but they don't make judgments. They do calculated decisions. You have to have an algorithm, a repeated process that you can program into the machine to get it to make your decision for you. They can make some incredibly complex decisions and do some incredibly complex evaluations, and that's beautiful in a way. It's very exciting that they can deal with large-scale systems and incredible complexity, and in certain well-understood systems, they can make decisions far better than a human could. But that's right, they'll take more into account. But they won't. But the assumptions have to be built in a sense, into the program. So they're not going to look at the bigger picture. They're not going to use creativity or intuition. You don't want them to use intuition. You want them to do it mechanically. So for a lot of situations where some kind of creativity is involved, the computer just can't make that leap. It's said basically that computers really have a hard time thinking holistically. I mean, that's almost by definition. They're not going to be able to see the whole big picture. It's been suggested that we should start training our children in schools to deal more intuitively with decision making, because the computers will be making the analytic decisions very well. No use teaching people how to make analytic decisions. We should maybe be teaching them to make the intuitive decisions that the computers can't make about systems that are not fully understood, which is most of our systems. We can't pretend to fully understand them. About systems where the data isn't all available. And despite the lack of complete data, you have to make a decision. And that's very common. I'd like to read a little section out of Weizenbaum. So, when I say that science has been gradually converted into a slow-acting poison, and thus computers, as part of science, I mean that the attribution of certainty to scientific knowledge by the common wisdom, which is an attribution now made so nearly universally that it has become common sense dogma, has virtually delegitimized all other ways of understanding. We look at science, we look at computers as the road to knowledge. Science means knowledge. I mean, that's where it comes from. The root of the word science in Latin, scientia or something like that. It was a Greek, but I'm not even sure. Who's our scholar? Greek. Is it Latin? Is knowledge. What happens to other routes to knowledge? What happens to inspiration? What happens to prayer? What happens to intuition? What happens to nonverbal communication? Okay, that's my second concern about computers. The effect on a whole lot of feelings. Employment. Computers are supposed to herald the new age in liberating us from drudgery, doing all the robotic type jobs that can be done mechanically, and supposedly we all benefit from that. Now, I guess I wouldn't feel so badly about things if the society were structured in such a way that we did all benefit from that. What happens is that instead we've laid off people in one sector of the economy, and we've hired people in another sector of the economy. And it turns out that we lay off the people that are doing the production line jobs or doing the jobs that the computer replaces. We lay off the secretaries because we don't need as many of them now because they can go faster with their new machines and do this stuff, get this stuff done. We lay off the machine operators who now don't do those type of jobs anymore. And we hire some, but fewer, in the high-tech industry, in the to make the computer chips. Those are different kinds of people. There's a few highly skilled, highly paid people being hired over here, and a lot of blue-collar people being laid off over here.
How do the Japanese deal with that situation? Do you have any information about that?
No, I don't. Do you know? Has anybody?
I've heard some recent reports that the Japanese economy is gearing up for a big computer war with the U.S. to take over the world market. And so a lot of their heavy industry and steel and car manufacture is going to be there, but there's going to be a lot less federal financing of it by their government. There's going to be a tremendous shift in the computer area. So they're training their people in a very technical way in Japanese schools, and they don't have a lot of the liberal arts and the other backgrounds that we pick up in our schools.
But I'm thinking here about the person who was painting the car in the assembly line who was no longer there because there's some robotics now, you know, painting the body of the car. You know, what happened to that person, you know, in Japan? I'm sure that at some point kind of had to deal with that person, either, you know, keep him on unemployment until he, you know, passed on or what. I just, you know, anyone had any information about how they were dealing with that situation.
I'm not sure, but I know that Japanese industry is much more paternalistic, and there's a great deal of loyalty to the company that a person works for. In fact, when they go to work, their intention is that they'll stay with that organization for their entire career. And it's also the assumption of the company that they take on certain responsibilities, so they may be doing some retraining of people.
I'm really sure that our job retraining system is basically every person for themselves. I mean, we just almost don't do it. So if you lay off somebody over here and you hire somebody over here, it's never the same person.
The company that I happen to work for.
Hey, we have an exception, good.
A lot of computers, but what we've done is taken people who were working for, a good example right now is people that are manually compiling reports and writing, just copying over from computer reports, but copying over the numbers and adding them together, make sure they check out. Well, that will all be done by computer. None of those people will lose their jobs. They'll be retrained to take over the new. There will be so many problems that the computer creates from this combined that they'll be simply, they will no longer have to do the manual type writing, rewriting numbers, but their job will actually be enhanced to do some thinking and try and figure out those problems and go back and research where we're off or where we're having problems. And our company as a whole has never laid off anyone because of computerization. We're a company that really relies on computers. And we really retrain, you know, we hire a lot of vocational technical people for some not so technical jobs. And we have an in-house training staff that actually makes them into whatever, programmers or some other aspect that we need.
That's the,
I agree that might be the exception, but there are some companies out there that do care for their employees.
I think it depends on whether you're more the user of the computer or trying to do the programming too. Like my industry too, it's the same way, but they're all users. You know, they're just using the data coming out of the machine basically. You know, you're more of a numbers world than you're in the get something done type world, in the production world.
That's, well, yeah, that's related to just the idea that it's not necessarily a more appealing job. I mean, like secretaries complain that typing and retyping part gets easier. But the workers hate many aspects of these new machines. The secretaries now have to deal with production quotas. Since performance on the job is evaluated much more in strictly objective terms, you can measure how much output there is. And it used to be that a clerical worker would also be evaluated for his or her personal human contribution of energy and ideas. Now there is hardly any variety in office work. The jobs are dead-ended, and because the human connection is eliminated, jobs are also less secure. Some people are calling office work the electronic assembly line.
As you talk, it alarms me that, I'm not saying computers are evil, but one of the key factors of evil is to treat people as though they are non-existent. And that seems to be one of the major effects of computers, that people are not recognized as persons.
It seems that the ones who are now the most vulnerable in employment become even more vulnerable. I think of my 64-year-old Title V employee who does all kinds of volunteer statistics by hand. And when our system, the statewide system, goes to computer statistics, her values as a person are going to be all the more important. But there is a dear sweet lady, but she's never going to be able to handle that transition. We can see it now. The housewife who is caught up, I guess, as a term, the electronic sweatshop, keep your computer at home, do your work, there's no fringe benefits.
No interaction with people. No.
Right. Yeah. Those who are the most marginal right now, the most at risk, become all the more at risk.
But hasn't that always been a problem? And
with every new technology.
I was wondering if we're recognizing
since the beginning of industrial age. Mm-hmm. You've got to retrain into better jobs.
There are some that I fear who will, at this particular gap or leap in the industrial process, will not be retrainable. And maybe that happens at all stages.
It is. Yeah. It always has been.
But then we need to recognize that and do institute social programs that counteract that effect of technology instead of just ignoring it and saying, oh, well, it's just the way the market works, it's just the way the system goes, and, you know, scrap a few people over here, don't worry about them. You know, give them unemployment for 6 months or however long we give it to them. How long does unemployment hold out? 9 months? A year?
Depends on how many extensions.
Depends on where you are. But anyway, it's finite length of time, and then dump them. You know, if they haven't figured out how to make a transition in 9 months, then the heck with them.
The concept of retraining it can be what's best for the company too, or the industry. Not necessarily is the person going to be have the same fulfillment or satisfaction. It's we'll reprogram you to do this, to do something else so you can retain your employment, but it may take a lot of the satisfaction out of it.
I think the same thing can happen in any situation, even without the computers. Our department right now is going through an efficiency study, and we have been wasting time and energy in so many ways, not even thinking about the computer yet, that I know we're going to be laying off temporary employees that we've had on staff, or that we've had working for us for 3 years, that we'll be laying off because we've been able to eliminate procedures where we've been holding hands with our customers, where it's just impossible to do. We have a million accounts and we can't hold hands as much as we have in the past.
Aha, so we cut out handholding.
We've been going overboard though. I mean, when we have 3-hour phone calls to a particular customer to help them take care of their problems, when that's really not our, it's not all of our job, we're not going overboard because we are very customer oriented.
I wasn't going to read this, but now I have to. We saw computers as being I'm not saying that in disagreement with what you say, that's fine. It's just it triggered by this response of this. We sort of feel like computers have become essential now. How could we have survived without them? I mean, there's so many things like airline industries and banking and finance world. You just couldn't possibly do the things we're doing without computers. So it's sort of like they arrived just in time to save us from this avalanche of bureaucratic paperwork and so forth that we could not have possibly dealt with. I mean, you could go into foreign countries and find out how they can't deal with it. It takes you 3 days to make one business transaction or something that would take 5 minutes here with punching the computer and zing, it's done. I want to read Weizenbaum's response to that kind of a statement about how grand it is that the computer arrived just in time. It may be that social services such as welfare could have been administered by humans exercising human judgment if the dispensing of such services were organized around decentralized indigenous population groupings such as neighborhoods and natural regions. But the computer was used instead to automate the administration of social services and to centralize it along established political lines. If the computer had not facilitated the perpetuation and, quote, improvement, unquote, of existing welfare distribution systems, and hence of their philosophical rationales, perhaps someone might have thought of eliminating much of the need for welfare by, for example, introducing negative income tax. The very erection of an enormously large and complex computer-based welfare administration apparatus, however, created an interest in its maintenance and therefore in the perpetuation of the welfare system itself. And such interests soon become substantial barriers to innovation, even if good reasons to innovate later accumulate. In other words, here's a summary of that idea. Many of the problems of growth and complexity that pressed insistently and irresistibly for response during the post-war decades could have served as incentives for social and political innovation. An enormous acceleration of social invention, had it begun then, would now seem to us as natural a consequence of man's predicament in that time, as does the flood of technological innovation and invention that was actually stimulated. Yes, the computer did arrive just in time. But in time for what? In time to save, and save very nearly intact indeed, to entrench and stabilize social and political structures that otherwise might have had to be either radically renovated or allowed to totter under the demands that were sure to be made on them. The computer, then, was used to conserve America's social and political institutions and buttressed them and immunized them, at least temporarily, against enormous pressures for change. That's representing the computer, then, as a very conservative instrument that allowed us to retain archaic ways of dealing with human problems, and to augment those to the point where now we can't get along without the computer, because we haven't gone through the necessary innovative, creative design processes, social design processes that might have been stimulated had we not had the computer to sort of bail us out and save us. What would we have done without airline schedules, computerized airline schedules? For one thing, there'd be a lot less confusion in the price rates.
And our luggage would have at least as good a chance of getting where it's supposed to
be. I think the process would work exactly the same, except it's just much slower. It's
slower.
By phone calls instead of by computer.
Yeah, there'd be a lot slower. That's the next point, in fact. Social pace and scale. Today's largest institutions, the military, the corporate, the bureaucratic, can only be large as permitted by their ability to communicate among their diverse parts quickly with mind-boggling amounts of data. Telecommunications have put the equation in those terms, shattering the limits of physical size that once existed. Now an entity can spread itself outward to encompass the entire planet. National boundaries are anomalies. The computerization and the communication revolution enabled the multinational corporations and the scale at which they are. If there's not anything intrinsically wrong with multinational corporations, but there's a lot of writings along the small is beautiful lines or the human scale lines that say that somehow we need to get back to having our institutions be of a human scale so that we can feel personally involved in them.
Yeah, would there be another aspect to that of saying that when you have a world economy, basically you have an interdependence not only on the computer, but you perhaps have a little more interdependence on another country or another people?
Right. And that world economy, while some people say that's what leads to peace, that interdependency, other people are saying that's what leads to exploitation. Mm-hmm. And that because in a market system, every transaction that takes place is not just a fair transaction, but always takes place with the person that is in the superior position economically. The person with more wealth gets a greater benefit from the transaction than the person with the lesser wealth. So market systems invariably will aggravate wealth differentials. I mean, only among equals do you get equal transactions. Then the market system works fine, and free trade is a beautiful thing, and it doesn't need things. But as soon as you get the unequals, trading, it's always to the advantage of the superior trader, the rates.
Here?
Yeah.
I'd like to plug that word interdependence, which you just used offhand casually, because that isn't interdependence. Even though we say, you know, we depend on so-and-so to get our chromium, you know, Zimbabwe or wherever. Technically, interdependence means what Gary just described. Where literally I need that person in roughly the same way that he or she needs me, and no one of us has sort of more clout or more club over the other one. The fact that Americans don't think in terms of interdependence, I think, even when we use that word, was reflected, it would be for me 10 years ago, some of you may be too young to remember that, when the oil crisis came, the first articulated goal of our country was to make ourselves relatively independent of Middle Eastern oil, if we could, so that we wouldn't have to be interdependent on other people in the world, and therefore have to stay at peace with other people in the world. And to be sure, that's risky to be interdependent because, you know, they can cut you off, but that means you have to have, you have to nurture human relations with those folks and not just economic or political clout relations. Where if you are then the superordinate party, you can, you know, exercise your clout on them and they can squeal and holler, but you can squeeze them. And from what little I've gathered in my third world connections, specifically Asia and Africa, that's the vast majority predominant view of the folks who feel that they're being squeezed, you know, by us and the European and Japanese counterparts who are big.
And Soviet counterparts.
Huh?
And Soviet counterparts.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Right.
That's not too many of them were in South Africa.
Oh, okay. Yeah, also the model of development as being one of foreign capital coming in, building up the country and employing everybody, and that way the country will prosper, is really being challenged by, you know, like Nicaragua, for example, and a number of third world, not only theorists, but also practice, saying that there has to be local production for local consumption, much more autonomy and less, for them, it's dependency on the foreign role in their country. And it turns out that most countries in the world can make it as individual, almost tradeless countries. They could make it if the land and the resources were used within the country. They would have an excess of some things, they'd have deficits of other things. Those things could be traded, but not at the scale that trade is going on in the world today. Free trade sounds like a neat thing, I mean, free and all that, but free trade is not to the advantage of a lot of countries. That's a whole other direction. Preaching here. read a little another paragraph on this. That as society increasingly emphasizes computers, we are receiving an ever-increasing amount of data, most of it unusable in any practical sense anyway. As life around us accelerates, we also accelerate. But it's not our minds which experience the acceleration. It is our nervous systems. It's the pace, it's the rate of the society that the computers help facilitate going faster. And I'm not sure that's healthy. I've often heard video games praised because they speed up hand-eye coordination. Right? That's what everybody wonders what they're good for. Oh, I know what they're good for. They speed up hand-eye coordination. Okay. In response, I ask, why is it a good thing to speed up hand-eye coordination? When the only real value, save perhaps for a professional basketball player, is to get up to speed for the next computer function. Ronald Reagan has not missed the point. He recently publicly praised video games. I didn't know this. He recently publicly praised video games as good training for a new generation of bomber pilots, whose task is similar to video game problems. He said that publicly? It's appalling. For 400,000 generations, human hand-eye coordination was attuned to an environment which operated at what you might call natural speed. Everything human beings had to deal with moved at speeds appropriate to our abilities, and vice versa. It would have to be that way for our species to have survived. But with the Industrial Revolution, many things began moving at mechanical speed, and as the natural environment was paved over, and as human beings moved into human-created environments, the natural rhythms which we formerly reacted, gave way to industrial rhythms. We learned to interact with mechanical speed. The clock was invented. It revolutionized our way of life. Because now we could tell the time of day to the second, or we could tell processes to the second. It wasn't just a matter of ringing the bell sometime around the middle of the day when the sun looked like it was about toward the top of the sky. You say, okay, we're going to have the noon prayers, folks. Everybody out. All of a sudden we could measure time with precision, and that just made a revolution. There's several books on that topic. They're fascinating. And now, machines move at electronic speed, and the wheel of activity turns even faster, and we're on it. This fellow, remember he wrote the book on TV, he says, I've argued for a long time that TV, while it pacifies the brain, speeds up the nervous system. The Australian National University report on TV as a cause of hyperactivity among children explained that a kid sitting silently watching TV might see people punching or killing each other. This stimulates the fight or flight reaction of the nervous system. But it's television. A physical reaction would be absurd. And so the body remains inert, and these feelings that are aroused are suppressed. When the set goes off, the saved up energy bursts forth in wild, formless, hyperactive behavior. If you have kids, you've probably seen this. I have kids and I've seen it. It's really true. When the program's over, when the set goes off, you can just see this pent-up energy just go crazy. And when they'll get up from reading a book, you don't have that same thing. It's the same thing, it's passive. You're sitting there just doing it, and yet it doesn't do the same thing when you finish reading a book. I think because you maybe pace it yourself instead of having it paced for you, but there's something different about that. Okay, so much for speed, huh? Computers, space, I'll read that. Okay, warfare. I'm not going to say a whole lot about warfare because I'm running out of time, but warfare is one way in which we could not possibly have the fantastic way we have of blowing up the world all in 5 minutes if we didn't have computers to orchestrate it for us. We wouldn't have to worry about things like launch on warning, because we wouldn't have the system to be able to do that. It would have taken us many hours to load the bombers and fly them over there and all this kind of stuff. But it's basically been the military dollars that have developed the computer industry. All of the computer stuff is a spillover from military expenses, R&D, research and development dollars. By the billions have gone into developing the semiconductors and the high-speed communications and stuff. Some of it was NASA, some of it was space program. But again, a lot of the space program was really, in order to feed military techniques, missiles for launching satellites, are the same missiles you use to launch, basically the same missiles you use to launch bombs. And then finally, I want to write these down so you'll remember them forever and ever. Employment.
Just now, I'm punching them on my computer.
Right. Social pace and scale. And there, I guess I won't say much beyond what I've already kind of said, that they magnify power. Computers, and they're meant to do that. They're meant to be an extension of our power. So insofar as we have wealth and power and equities in the world, the computers into that structure magnify those power and wealth and equities. For every nice use I can make of a little mini computer in my home, somebody else out there with more power than I, more wealth than I, will be making use of the higher generation, the next generation of computer to affect them. It's always sounded to me so sort of utopian to have access, say, to the Library of Congress, where I could just sit down at my computer terminal and get any text of any book in front. We'll probably have that sometime before too long. But what can I do with that if I'm basically not too highly educated, if I'm not too fluent with knowing the systems of indexing and cross-indexing, cross-cross-indexing? That accessibility to information magnifies the power of those who know how to play the game, and it diminishes the power of those that don't. And there's a lot of people in the world who don't know how to play the game. And they're just going to be left out more and more and more. So in a sense, I'm opposed to the magnification of power as long as it's going to this effect of greater increasing of the rich-poor gap and not toward an equalization of that gap. So ends my speech.
So
do you have more? Yeah. What's the solution? I'm going to drag my feet. I don't know. I guess I think a public consciousness of the negative effects is helpful. I mean,
I was thinking
being able to articulate to your friends why you have reservations about them, where those inequities need to be recognized and maybe worked against or counterbalanced somehow. Making sure if they try to get computers into the schools that both boys and girls have equal access to them, that both rich and poor have equal access to them. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Oh, sorry.
One thing is to not buy one. It seems like as a Christian, in one way, with the temptations of Christ of power, the fame, the money, whatever those were, that's the whole message, is to give up man's idea of power and to assume that other positions, and maybe we identify with the power.
But the question becomes, what tools do you want, what tools don't you want? Do you say, well, let's not learn to read because you might read bad books?
No, but it's a human process in my mind, rather than it's not a kind of power I want to be identified with. It's more the power of love and meeting people and touching people and growing things and creating with the mind rather than machine.
What do you do with your kids, though? Do you keep them from learning computer?
We talk about it a lot. Well, we didn't buy one on purpose.
Uh-huh.
Because we also limit our television a great deal because of the power of imagery. Yeah, I use imagery a lot in therapy, and I see the power of imagery on people's behavior. It's phenomenal. So we talk about it a lot, and we just choose to identify with the intuitive, and a lot with prayer. You know, we spend our time looking that way.
The only thing I would say there is you can carry that back too with the automobile and the plane, and that's it seems to me the Amish, what they've done is, you know, they've drawn that line a while ago, and you know, and I guess it's exactly what you're saying. Where do you, what tools do you use? And I, you know,
there's the trick is to, I mean, as a Christian, I guess, how do you prevent the idolatry of the automobile, the plane, the computer? And that's what seems to be so fearful. It's not computers per se. It's not. It's the way they're used in the society. It's the way they're worshipped and the way the application is.
I think our job as Christians is not so much to ignore the computer, but to learn how to live with them and learn how to work within them.
And keep pointing at the ways in which they're within magnifying the injustice.
Yeah. Within your company.
Yeah. Ask for some accountability.
Yeah.
Yeah. The key is tool. I think we need to be accepting of that and use it as a tool. And that's what we ask for, the accountability.
And one of the keys is on decision making. Computers should not make decisions. Mm-hmm. Computers should only provide another piece of information in the decision process. Mm-hmm. But obviously, there's got to be a human to make that decision. And he takes information that's provided by the computer and his own feelings and any other pieces of information provided by other sources, and then use that total piece of information as the decision for the human decision, not allow the computer to do that based upon raw facts, which may be...
That's ideal. What happens when the Soviets launch their missiles 6 minutes from our shores, and we've got 2 minutes to confirm whether it was indeed a launch or whether it was a mistake of our computer chip, and then we finally confirm that yes, it wasn't a launch, and then we get the information to the president, and we say, okay, Mr. President, now you have 3 minutes to decide whether or not we're supposed to push these buttons. Actually, 2 minutes, because it's going to take a minute to get the buttons pushed, so quick, tell us. And what's the situation?
That process will never be computerized. Never, ever. It won't be allowed.
It has to be computerized.
No, it won't. I disagree with that. It never will be. There's got to be a person in here, a person who is the ultimate check whether or not that's...
Okay, the Soviets have threatened to computerize that process when we put our missiles into Europe, because they said now we're going to be 6 minutes away from a first strike attack that could wipe out all our missile silos. How are we going to get our missiles out to defend ourselves against your first strike? The only way we can possibly do it is to get them out while your missiles are on your way, those silos, so they'll be empty when they hit. The only way we can make that decision in 6 minutes without consulting the Politburo is to have it all programmed as to under what conditions to make the decision ahead of time, in effect. Under what conditions will we launch our missiles? Well, if so many thousands of years have already been launched, then we will launch our whole set. And that's going to be a computerized decision. And we said, no, they won't do that. That's just bluffing. Why shouldn't they do that if they're afraid that we can wipe them out in a first strike?
I don't trust them not to do that. Nor do I trust us not to do that with their submarines off our coast.
I think your point in teaching children especially to make a better, more intuitive decisions, accepting information. Mm-hmm.
Thank you all for your good input, too. That got me thinking about things.